This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Helen Fisher, reader in developmental psychopathology at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience at King's College London. Helen has spent nearly two decades researching the etiology and treatment of psychosis in young people. Welcome, Helen. Hi, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Can you start with an introduction about what you do?
Yeah, so I always consider myself to be an interdisciplinary scientist. So I have a background originally in psychology, but my PhD is actually in social epidemiology and psychiatric genetics. And then from that point, I've really embraced the idea of interdisciplinarity and have brought lots of different strands, so things like epigenetics, environmental science, and the arts into the work I do to really help me understand why young people develop psychosis, so what puts them at risk, but also what we can do to actually prevent them from developing those problems.
You specialise in the etiology and treatment of psychosis in young people, and I'm wondering what prompted your initial interest in that
area. So I think two things. So the first was that during my psychology degree, I did a four-year degree where I did a placement with a mental health team to actually understand what that was like, with the idea that I might do clinical psychology, which I didn't. Mm-hmm. And during that, I had the opportunity to sit in a psychiatric ward round, which is kind of unusual for a 19-year-old to have that opportunity, I'm sure, actually admitted. And it was really fascinating, but the first person that came into the ward round who sat next to where I was a young guy of about the same age as me, but huge. So he was about 7 foot tall, about 5 foot wide, very imposing, and had been admitted for psychosis. Right. And what was fascinating about it was that he was quivering sitting next to me because he was completely convinced that I was going to hurt him, which completely, from my point of view, was completely the opposite of what I expected. And so for me, really what that made me think about was I really wanted to understand how could someone get to a point of believing something that was so clearly not true that it really had a kind of a physical and emotional effect on them. And so that really led me to wanting to understand how people develop these symptoms, particularly in adolescence, where it's very common. I think the second thing is that I had an uncle who had chronic schizophrenia.
Oh, okay.
And that's not actually why I originally was interested in the area, but I guess is related. The problem was at the point at which he was diagnosed, really the only treatment available at that point, other than hospitalisation, was he basically stayed at home and took a really strong antipsychotic. Which was important to control the symptoms he was experiencing, but kind of meant that he really did nothing else. So from the age of 15 to 65, he literally sat at home, took his medication, smoked, and did nothing with his whole life. And I just, you know, he was a lovely guy, but it just, to me, was just really upsetting that he just didn't have the opportunity to live his life or contribute in any way to society. And I think that really underlies my real enthusiasm for early intervention. So really early on, when an individual develops psychosis, really going in with a whole range of services to really help them get back on track, and even if they continue to experience symptoms, actually find a way to increase their quality of life, get back into university or a job, and rather than just a kind of a waste, I think.
You describe this powerful image of the large patient that you saw very early on in your career. And I was wondering what psychosis looks like in young people.
I guess the first thing to say is that actually I tend to look at psychosis across a full spectrum. Mm-hmm. So normally when we think about psychosis, we think about people who have a full-blown psychotic disorder. Mm-hmm. So they're hearing voices, they're very paranoid, it dominates their whole life, they're thinking, it's having a huge impact on them, it's incredibly distressing. That kind of psychotic disorder in adolescence is actually the peak incidence of that is kind of around 17 to 25. Mm-hmm. So in kind of late adolescence, early adulthood. So it does look very similar to, you know, from that point on, it kind of is similar. And obviously, very old age, it is, is often quite different. And so the kind of symptoms and experiences are the same. I guess the content of them is sometimes different because it more reflects what's happening to the person at the time. What I'm kind of increasingly interested in is kind of that spectrum, though, is the kind of lower end. So kind of later in childhood and during early adolescence and then also into adulthood, people having much lower end spectrum experiences. So they're maybe occasionally hearing a voice or just hearing whisperings or sounds that they're not quite sure what they are. They're a little bit more paranoid or jealous. Things are just not quite right. And so those experiences tend to occur in kind of late childhood, early adolescence. They continue often into adulthood. But those are the experiences I'm really interested in because I think it's a good opportunity for us to get in and perhaps intervene before someone gets to that full-blown
And do they get state. Picked up or do people try and hide those sort of...
Yeah, I think people do hide them. I think in late childhood, early adolescence, people often don't kind of know what's going on. And I think those kind of experiences are considered really very taboo still in our society. People feel very comfortable talking, maybe wrongly, but talking about feeling depressed and feeling anxious, but they certainly don't say, I feel psychotic very often. We all feel like we want to kind of distance ourselves from that. So I think people do, but I think also we never ask. So I think until fairly recently, we never knew that children actually and adolescents had these kind of experiences because no one actually asked them. So I think in large general population studies, I mean, a decade or so ago, people started to actually ask, as they're asking lots of other mental health systems, they actually started to ask children in their studies about these and actually realised that actually they are much more common than we had expected. And for many kids, they'll kind of just disappear, but for others they will continue, and almost regardless of that, they do indicate that those kids will have a lot of problems later, potentially.
What is the prevalence of psychosis in adolescents in the UK?
For psychotic disorder at that kind of full end of the spectrum, it's around 3%, but it really depends. It's very socially and geographically patterned. So it depends on a variety of things. So your ethnic group, your minority, in relation to your minority status and other things you're experiencing, whether you live in a city, whether you live in the country, even within the UK, it does actually fluctuate quite a bit. At the lower end of the spectrum, really kind of attenuated experiences can occur in up to about 30% of the adolescent population. For kind of more kind of strictly defined symptoms, so really hearing a voice, but without having all the other problems that lead to a disorder, that's around sort of 5-6% and dissipates a little bit through adolescence.
Going back to that interplay of psychosis and childhood maltreatment and victimisation, I know a lot of your research centres around that. Can you say a bit more about that, the interplay between those two?
Yeah, so it's been kind of a growing area of research over the last sort of decade or so, and lots of different people involved, really showing that several different types of victimisation, as I say, abuse, but also neglect and bullying and witnessing violence within the home, all seem to be associated with around a kind of twofold increased risk of having these symptoms in childhood and adolescence, and certainly also of them persisting over time. And we think that's for a variety of reasons. It may be that actually it's associated with other things that we're not taking into account, but it's probably to do with what that means for the person psychologically and biologically. So some of those things, not all of them, so things like sexual abuse and bullying can be very stressful. We know that stress has a biological reaction. We can feel it when we feel stressed, and we know that the inflammation and other things that causes can alter how the brain works, and that can lead to changes that may actually trigger these symptoms. We also know that if you experience those things particularly pervasive, so particularly multiple types, so you're at home, you're getting abused, you go to school, someone's victimizing, you go online, someone's bullying you, and it becomes a pervasive thing, that your view of the world as you're growing up starts to change. And so it isn't uncommon for people in those situations to start, as a way of protecting themselves in a way, kind of attribute hostility to everybody that they start to meet, because they're trying to protect themselves. So they might begin to think that other people are likely to hurt them as a protective thing to keep themselves away, which would be sensible in that situation. And it doesn't take much then for that idea to develop into something more order like paranoia or a kind of more persecutory type of delusion. Also, if you've been victimised, you might also be struggling to relate to other people. You might not have as much support as you might have otherwise. And it may be that if you have anomalous experiences, by which I mean you might kind of hear something and you don't know what that is, you haven't got someone perhaps to talk that through with and normalise that. So, you know, we all hear random things, it's probably just something else, and dismiss it. You might get, you know, more interested in that and think more about it, worry about it more, and that then might develop more into something like an auditory hallucination, a voice that you begin to hear.
Is that ever a comfort a retreat.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really important to think about, particularly when we think about hearing voices, that we tend to generally think about those as being unpleasant, distressing, but actually a lot of them are actually very pleasant, or they're quite benign and actually they're just there. Those experiences are actually fairly common in the general population because actually they're not always distressing. Okay. They can be supportive, it can be a friend if you haven't got any other friends, if you're very lonely.
You're a British Academy Mid-Career Fellow at King's. Mm-hmm. Your work has explored the social, psychological and epigenetic factors that increase and decrease the risk of psychotic experiences developing and persisting during adolescence amongst victimised children. You've touched on some of these. I think it would be helpful to explore each in turn.
Yeah.
So starting with the social factors that might put a young person at risk.
So I think obviously the main one I look at is their relationships with other people in terms of, you know, particularly being victimised by other people is the kind of key thing I look at socially. But related to that really as well is the kind of broader social world. So we don't operate in a bubble. We have interactions with people and our family, but also the wider environment. And certainly some of the work we've done when we've looked at living in a city, for instance, what we find actually kind of explains why we might see symptoms more in that sphere is because actually people are within there living in areas where actually there isn't much what we call social cohesion. So there's not much trust between neighbours, there's no one really to turn to for support. There's a lot of crime and general disorder in the area, so people don't feel very safe. So I think those factors on the social tend to be problematic. On the flip side, what's protective, not surprisingly, is slightly the opposite of that. So living in a much more kind of supportive, broader environment where people feel comfortable and safe, but also growing up, even despite experiencing things like bullying and other types of victimisation, if you actually live in a family which is nurturing and supportive and someone actually cares, actually that makes a huge difference and is very protective even in the context of quite severe victimisation.
What about the psychological factors? Which increase risk and those that decrease it?
So there are a range of things that are likely. The ones that I've looked at are really in the context of children and adolescents who've been exposed to victimisation. And what we see there is kind of two things that seem to increase their risk. One is that actually if they're victimised, if they become what we call an affective pathway, if they become more depressed or anxious, actually those kind of initial mental health symptoms can trigger moving towards psychosis. The other one really is what we call having an externalising locus of control. So what I mean by that is that actually someone begins to think that if they've been victimised, that actually they don't have any personal control over what's happening to them, that everything is out of their hands. It's all about other people influencing what's happening to them, or fate, or something kind of bigger
done to
picture. And they begin to feel kind of helpless, and they don't really feel that they can have any agency in the world. And that seems to be important to a degree to paranoia, but also with things like hearing voices where actually they don't, if they hear something, instead of thinking it's just me generating that sound or thought, they think it must be something else.
Right.
So they begin to have that belief that other things are actually generating what's happening, and therefore more likely to attribute things to voices or other factors. The other one is low self-esteem. And again, that's not really surprising in the context of victimisation. Again, a slightly different thing, which is blaming yourself for everything.
What about the epigenetic factors? What role do they play?
So when we're looking at epigenetics, really what we're talking about is something that regulates how our genes work. So we all know we've got DNA, and that's pretty fixed across the life course. But there's a whole kind of chemical layer above it and things that happen to it, then that can influence how those genes actually work. So we're not going to change the gene, but you can actually change whether how much it's working or not. Mm-hmm. We think, as well as the internal kind of environment in the cell and the body, that actually external things can come in and influence that. And so particularly things that are stressful, which, as I say, have in themselves a biological reaction, that biological reaction, the change in how our hormones are working, can influence potentially how our genes change. And so that might be one thing that's happening, and that change in how the genes are working may influence how the brain develops, how it functions, and again that might lead on to psychotic phenomena being triggered. What we've seen is that we certainly see some of these changes in gene regulation occurring prior to the development of psychotic symptoms in mm-hmm. kids, and we see differences if they persist over time, and if they stop during adolescence, we see right. the epigenetic changes also changing.
Okay.
But what we don't see really is with victimization, there's a really mixed field, and certainly in our work, we don't see particularly strong associations between victimization and these changes. We see something for sexual abuse, but it's mm-hmm. it's not really very clear, and it's not clear for the others. So, which is surprising given how mm. stressful those are, and that we see similar things in animal models.
Right.
We see these changes, but we don't see them as much in humans. They're much more complicated. So the idea that something like victimization or some kind of stress might change how our genes are working and then lead to psychosis is a nice theory, but we mm. don't really have the evidence to show that that's really happening. So at the moment it's very theoretical. As I say, mm-hmm. what we can see are changes occur prior to the onset of the symptoms. We just don't know why
yeah,
they're occurring. If you were to replicate that work a lot and think about it very carefully, technically in a long way in the future, you could think about potentially doing a blood test to see these changes, or a cheek swab to see the changes, mm-hmm. and you could potentially predict that someone might develop these symptoms. So that could be a way of screening people to intervene, I would suggest, mm. probably with psychological therapy rather than biological agents. But I think we're a long way from that still. Mm.
Talking about prediction and on predicting which victimised children will go on to develop psychopathology in late adolescence, and given the factors that you have mm. described, how can this knowledge be utilised?
The thing with victimisation is we know victimisation increases risk for a huge number of mental health and physical health problems. Mm-hmm. So, and we now know, you know, from the work I've done and many other people, that it also increases your risk of having psychotic symptoms and psychotic disorders. So I think it's a fairly no-brainer that we should do something about victimisation.
Right.
I don't think that's, most people disagree with that. It's just very hard to do. It's very hard to eradicate people. Mm-hmm. You know, there are various intervention programs, particularly around bullying, that have shown some effectiveness, and people are trying to implement those. It's much harder to prevent sexual abuse, physical abuse in the home. There mm-hmm. are parenting programs, but things like sexual abuse tend right. to occur outside. So preventing it is really important, but it's
right.
hard. Sometimes it's more going to be about tackling it if we're aware of it. In terms of the other factors, what we really need to do, and we haven't done, is really look at, if we pull them together, what kind of constellation of those factors or is really important mm-hmm. to have the best prediction. So people are starting to do some of that work, and there's some very fancy statistics
right.
that can be done to try and do that.
You mentioned this earlier, but your current research program examines the role of the wider environment, mm. including neighbourhood social factors and air pollution, in the emergence of psychotic phenomena. Can you share a bit more about this work?
Yeah, so one of my team, Joanne Newbury, did her PhD trying to understand whether the really common association we see between living in a city and having a psychotic disorder, whether we see that also at this kind of lower end of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And we do. We see that living in a city, and at least in the UK, means you're much more likely to have these kind of low-level psychotic phenomena and psychotic symptoms in both late childhood and later in adolescence than if you live in a rural area
mm-hmm.
or just a town in the UK. And her work has really looked at, firstly, at the social factors.
Mm-hmm.
So what she found was that even within a city, there's variation.
Mm-hmm.
And she really found that it was people who lived in a city, but the area they lived in had this really low trust between neighbours
mm-hmm.
And lack of support and much higher levels of crime and disorder. They explained about half of the association between living in the city and having
mm-hmm.
these psychotic experiences. But then we were like, well, it's only half of it.
Yeah.
So some of the other half is error and other things, but there must be something else.
Right.
And we thought, well, actually, one of the big things in cities, certainly in terms of physical health, is air pollution. And we know that some of the very fine particles in air pollution can actually, you inhale them, but they can actually also pass the blood-brain
mm.
barrier. So we know they affect the lungs and
right.
other organs, but they can actually get into the brain. And so there's a little bit of work suggesting that actually if that happens in childhood and adolescence, the brain is developing, that actually it can stunt the development of parts of the brain, or it can change how it's actually working. And so we thought, well, actually that seems feasible in terms
right.
of then having a potential impact on psychosis as well. and other mental health problems. So within a large general population study that we work on called ERIS, the Environmental Risk Study, across the UK, we were able to work with environmental scientists to actually model their pollution exposure in these kids earlier on and at different points in adolescence. And what we find is that adolescents who are exposed to the highest levels of air pollution, so particularly nitrogen oxides and nitrogen dioxides, which tend to be mainly from transport, they had much higher rates of these psychotic experiences than people exposed to kids exposed to lower levels. And this explained actually again about this was about it explained about 60% of the association between living in the city and having these experiences. So for us, that's really fascinating, and we're starting to think a bit more about why that might be and trying to get a little bit at those mechanisms. So we also know air pollution can cause inflammation in the brain, and inflammation can also affect things like the dopamine system and other things that have been linked to psychotic phenomena. So we're really trying to pull apart a bit those mechanisms. Just to say that one of the things that is really important with this work is that what we certainly can't say at this point is that it definitely causes it. We can't say that about any of it. We know they're associated, but it could easily be something else. So in the case of air pollution, one of the things it could be is noise, because a lot of it in the UK is generated by traffic, and traffic is noisy. And noise is stressful. It can also, depending on where you live, it can disrupt your sleep, if you're struggling to sleep. And both that stress and the problems with sleeping are both also things that we've previously associated with development of psychosis and psychotic phenomena. So it's very difficult to model noise exposure. And so at this point, we can't control for the noise when we're looking at the air pollution, if you see what I mean. So it's difficult to know what it is.
Confounding variables.
Yeah, it may be that the eventual common pathway, so the impact on the brain is actually the same thing. It might be inflammation and changing the way it's working, but how it gets there might be different.
Okay. What other research projects are currently live that excite you?
So I think one of the other biggest ones that I work on at the moment is actually something which is more in the global mental health field. So a lot of my previous work is very UK focused. Right. I work mainly on UK cohorts. But I had an opportunity a couple of years ago to go to an event where we got together with lots of different people around the world, and we developed a project called the IDEA Project. So that's identifying depression early in adolescence. So it's moving me away from psychosis, moving to depression. Okay. And really it's a collaboration between academics and clinicians in different parts of the world to really understand if we can identify adolescents who are at risk of developing depression much earlier than we can at this point. So depression, so although most of my work is on psychosis, depression itself actually is probably a bigger global mental health problem. It affects a much larger number of people. It mainly has its incidence onset in adolescence, and it's the kind of leading cause of illness and disability in the world amongst the adolescent population. And actually 90% of the world's adolescents live in lower middle income countries. They don't live in high income countries, and so actually those countries have the greatest burden of depression and the most opportunities to do something about it. So we're working with colleagues in Brazil, Nepal and Nigeria, so both low and middle income countries, to really see, can we identify in this early adolescent period which adolescents are most at risk of having depression kind of by the time they get to sort of 18, so that we could then develop interventions. So a little bit like we were talking earlier, we're actually using quite sophisticated statistical techniques using existing large population studies to see what combination of factors might be most risky for somebody. And with the idea that if you could look at those, you could actually develop a really clear screening tool that could be used in schools or other places. There's a lot of ethical issues around that, but you could potentially identify kids and do something about it.
I've read you're working on a program that aims to improve public understanding of psychosis through immersive art experiences, which sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
Can you, what is it about?
Yeah, so I think as we touched on earlier, I do kind of feel that psychosis and psychotic symptoms such as hearing voices really are the kind of last taboo area of mental health in the UK. So we talk a lot about mental health in the UK now, which is great, and lots of people talking about it, but people don't really feel comfortable still with psychosis. And I think a lot of that is because they don't understand what it feels like, what those phenomena are. They're quite different. Mm. Although I say that, you know, they're on a spectrum, it's difficult to identify where you've had a similar experience. So although you can get people to talk about it and people can write stuff about it, I kind of felt that actually what's really important is probably to give people their own personal experience of some of these symptoms so they understand what it feels like. And then they can begin to think about it, be aware of it, and start to perhaps help you feel more comfortable talking about it with other people, and maybe people can get help a bit earlier. So what we did, we've done a variety of things, but the kind of the key thing we did a few years ago was to actually, with young people who have these experiences, and a range of artists, actually develop an immersive experience. So we, in the middle of Peckham, set up an art gallery. We borrowed some lovely art from a guy called Toby Brown, who has a diagnosis of schizophrenia and paints some amazing pictures. And we actually gave people headsets like you would normally if you went into an art gallery, and they listened to the normal kind of audio tour about the pictures and mental health. But what we had in a concealed room was actors who actually provided voices, individual voices, to each person with the headphones. So they were watching them on CCTV, so the person didn't know they were there. And as they were listening to the audio guide, we overlaid voices in it. So as you're listening to the guide and I'm walking towards a particular picture, I'm suddenly getting a voice through these headphones as well, saying, no, don't stand too close to that. Or
did they know that was...
No, they didn't know that. They knew they were going to have something immersive, but we didn't tell them exactly what that was. We also did obviously tell them before that if you know, it might be distressing or it might not be, if they you could take the headphones off at any time and it would stop, kind of thing, for ethical reasons, and we had someone watching to make sure everyone was okay. And what we tried to do was give people a range of different experiences. So some of the voices were more negative. We were very careful not to do anything too distressing for them. The young people were really clear they didn't want anyone to feel as distressed as they often did, and that was really important. But some of them were more negative. Some of them were more just commenting, so kind of benign, you're doing this, I see you walking. And some of them were really playful and fun and supportive, and, oh, go at you, this is great fun, go and flip that person's ear, something kind of childish. To really give an idea of the spectrum of things that people experience. So we did that. We also had a part which people entered into a kind of tube simulation where they also got the idea, the feeling of what it feels like kind of on a visual level to have a lot of visual overstimulation as well. And the important thing was that after the experience, we got people to sit in a group because everyone had a slightly different voice, as I say, across the spectrum, to talk about what it felt like for them, and to also realise that not everyone's experience was the same, what that meant. So really for us started that conversation, and people from the feedback we got just found it really insightful. It seemed to increase their level of empathy and kind of understanding of this and make them think about something they hadn't before.
What an incredible project.
And so off the back of that, we're doing a variety of things like that, and actually the project I'm working on right now is a bit broader than that. Around awareness. So I'm actually working with the National Gallery and we're developing a kind of mental health themed audio tour of the gallery. So thinking on a slightly, because I guess the thing with immersive experiences, it's very expensive, it's very time consuming, and you can only really give it to a few people. Yeah, it's quite difficult to do on scale. So we really wanted to think about, we still want to do that kind of work, but also can you do something that's really accessible to millions of people, and you know, millions of people visit the National Gallery from all over the world every year. So we're actually creating a tour with young people with lived experience, so that if you go to the gallery, you can choose their, put on the normal audio tour thing and actually hear even about mental health problems and things that you might not have heard before, and take the tour as if you were a young person with mental health problems going through the gallery. So we're going to launch that on the 10th of October for World Mental Health Day, and advertise that more nearer the time.
What else can be done to improve public understanding of psychosis?
I think a lot of different things. I think other things that I've been involved in are working with theatre companies so that if they're portraying it, to portray authentically and then have discussions with audiences. As I say, there are a range of immersive things. I think there's online opportunities through social media. A lot of people have YouTube channels. There's obviously celebrities who talk about things and other people who talk. And I think it's one of those things where people are going to relate to different things. So some people will go to the theatre and see that. Some people might go to the National Gallery and get an experience there. Some people might go to a particular event or listen to a particular celebrity or prominent person or read something. So I think there are going to be different things that appeal to different people. So we probably need different things. I think it's also really important to think about how we bring that into the kind of mental health education that's starting in schools.
Yeah.
And certainly one of the people I've worked with a lot is a guy called Johnny Benjamin, who has a diagnosis of schizoaffective disorder and does a lot of work both on TV but also actually going into schools mm-hmm. and talking about what it feels like for him with adolescents, so that they feel more comfortable about it. They understand that other people experience these things. So I think through all these different mediums, we can start to get people to feel more comfortable about it and talk about it. And that should start to dispel some of the stigma. And hopefully people can, particularly adolescents, can feel more comfortable talking about it if they have kind of early experiences or later ones. If they can start to feel more comfortable talking about it, they might not continue, or at least if they need help, they might be able to get that a bit sooner.
Yeah. What else is in the pipeline that you'd like to mention?
So I think at the moment, one of the areas I'm really keen to work on is to extend the work on pollution. We're currently applying for money to really actually understand the links between air pollution and psychosis, but also particularly depression, which has also shown a strong association, but in different parts of the world. So although we have relatively high rates of pollution in the UK, they're nowhere near as high as they are in other parts of the world. And I think if you really want to understand a phenomenon, you've got to look at that more extreme case. So we're starting to build some collaborations with people in Nepal, which has one of the places with the worst air quality in the world because it's landlocked by India and China, so all their pollution comes in. No one lives in that lovely, on the lovely mountain, they all live in the belt of the world, so it kind of gets stuck. So we're doing some work to try and see if we can really assess air pollution exposure properly in that country in different ways, and then see if we can link it to our kind of prediction models of depression and psychosis. So we're doing some work on that particularly, and as I say, extending our kind of understanding of what the mechanisms are in relation to psychosis and depression. So is it that actually it's to do with the brain becoming inflamed? Is it more to do with actually the stress of noise and other factors? So we're trying to kind of move that forward.
Helen, you recently joined the editorial board of the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, the JCPP. What do you hope to bring to the role?
So I'm hoping to bring enthusiasm and a real opportunity to encourage people to submit methodologically robust research where they look at helping us understand more about the etiology and also how we might prevent and intervene with adolescents in terms of psychotic phenomena across the spectrum. So from these very early experiences through to psychotic disorder.
Finally, Helen, what is your takeaway message for those listening or watching our conversation?
So I think, as I say, the important thing really is that it would be great if people could think about psychosis as much more of a spectrum, and so not just focus on the severe end of the spectrum, but also think about, particularly in adolescence, that children and adolescents are quite likely to be having these types of experiences, and that if we could conduct research to really help us understand which children are most at risk of having these types of kind of lower level experiences and other mental health problems, and what might protect them from going on and having more severe mental illnesses later, we really could develop interventions to help the most vulnerable children as early as possible, and that would really give us hope that we might actually prevent severe mental illness from ever occurring at all.
Helen, brilliant. Thank you ever so much. To read more about Dr. Helen Fisher and her work on psychosis, visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.